Our current politics may have you wondering if anything like this has happened before. This hour, former Congressman Jim Leach on what is precedented and unprecedented. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Jim Leach served the people of Iowa in the U.S. Congress for 30 years, ending in 2007. Following his time in Congress, he taught at Princeton and at Harvard. Now he's on the faculty at the University of Iowa College of Law. Tomorrow in Iowa City, he'll be giving a public talk about how the past may or may not be helpful in making sense of the current political season. A conversation with former Congressman Jim Leach coming up. First, this hour's news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest this hour is former Congressman Jim Leach. Jim Leach served the people of Iowa in the U.S. Congress for 30 years, ending in 2007 as a member of the Republican Party. Following his time in Congress, Leach taught at Princeton University, also at Harvard. And now he's on the faculty at the University of Iowa College of Law. Tomorrow in Iowa City, he'll be giving a public talk titled What is Precedented and Unprecedented in American Politics? That's at 7 p.m. at the Englert Theater in downtown Iowa City. Former Congressman Jim Leach joins us in our Iowa City studio today. Congressman Leach, great to have you back on the program.
Honored to be with you, Ben.
Before we have, I ask you to share a little bit about what you'll be talking about tomorrow evening. I'd like to ask you, as a longtime respected public figure, about the mass shooting in Orlando on Sunday. Our culture of violence and the gun debate in this country. What are your thoughts after what is the largest mass shooting in U.S. history?
Well, I think all Americans are affected by this in many deep ways. I mean, this is a hate crime to begin with. It's also a terrorist act and tied to what might be called Islamist radicalism. It also may be a mental health issue. Now, all of these things are also tied together with the fact that the freest kind of society is the most vulnerable to terrorism, and that's the United States. And our freedoms also extend in some ways under our Constitution to how we deal with the gun issue. And there are many different perspectives on this. I think reasonable people have to come to understand that there must be an effort to somehow make it harder for certain kinds of weapons to get in the hands of certain kinds of people. And the case under our Constitution has some preclusions of restraints, and it also has some open doors. And one of the possible open doors that I think ought to be on the public table today is whether the Attorney General can designate a group of people and get a court order that might suggest that people on a terrorist list should be denied the capacity to buy guns.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that capacity in our kind of society will never be ironclad, because there are so many ways to slip into the gun buying side roads. But at a minimum, I think that is something that society is going to have to consider.
Let's talk a little bit about your talk tomorrow more broadly about our political season. And as I read your title here, how it fits in the context of the politics, American politics going way back. What is precedented and unprecedented in American politics, the title of your talk. Give us a little preview of what you want to get into with your audience.
Well, I was thinking of starting with some aspects of the founding of the Republic, and I'll get into that at the moment. But because of this incident and because of the bringing to the fore of the new kinds of threats that come from abroad in new kinds of ways, and especially with religion coming to the fore, I thought at the beginning of the year that there was one historical phenomenon that might be close to one-to-one to this year. As it works out, it's maybe partly relevant, and this is the year 1856. And in 1856, we had the first Republican candidate for president of the United States, and he was a strong candidate named John C. Fremont, who married the first five-term United States senator named Thomas Hart Benton from Missouri's daughter. And this is Thomas Hart Benton, who had a grandson by that name, who was a great artist that was of the regionalist era of Grant Wood. But in any regard, in that particular race, the old conservative party, which was called the Whigs, basically disappeared just almost overnight. And it had begun that process 2 years earlier. But in disappearing, Whigs became Republicans, and they also became members of something called the American Party, which was otherwise known as the Know-Nothings. And the Know-Nothing Party basically had a single-issue platform of being anti-immigrant and particularly virulently anti-Catholic. It argued that Catholics coming to this country would have first allegiance to the papacy rather than to their new homeland. One of the candidates for mayor, who was a polymath named Morris, who had developed the Morse code and had been one of the great portrait painters of an era, argued that Catholics could not even serve in public life because of their dual allegiance. And in some ways, it was more virulent then than it is today vis-a-vis the Islamic faith. And I thought maybe we would have that kind of third party with Trump as the third party candidate. As it worked out, Trump became the Republican candidate. And so he spoiled my one-to-one analogy. But there are certain facts and features of that 1856 race that is very relevant today, mm-hmm. But not in exactly the way the parties were structured. Now, it's quite possible that this is going to be a party realignment year. It's possible the Republicans are going to be relatively unified. It's also possible that a case for a new political alignment might appear. I mean, I sometimes ruminate whether we shouldn't have a principled pragmatic party, a PPP. And if the Republicans don't become a PPP, maybe a PPP would emerge.
Well, what would be the core of that PPP
well,
party?
Well, the core would probably be center-right and center-left in the American political spectrum. But forming a political party is a really, really hard thing to do. And now the libertarians are doing it to some degree today. In fact, one poll had them achieving perhaps as much as 10% of the vote in this election. That's conceivable. I don't know if that'll happen or not. None of us do. But this is a year that many people are enthused by Mr. Trump and many people are appalled by Mr. Trump. And so that's intriguing. Likewise, we have a Democratic candidate who is, according to public opinion polls, the most disliked Democratic candidate in American history. And so this is a year of angst. And in some ways, some of the angst is truly understandable. After all, we've gone through the two longest and arguably most debilitating wars in American history and still involved in them. And we had a man-made recession that we are still recovering from. Mm-hmm. And so an anti-establishment sense has developed in both political parties. It's slightly different in each, but it is, frankly, quite understandable.
Understandable, you say, but I have to bring up the point that nearly all political analysts were surprised by Donald Trump. He was laughed at in June of 2015 when he announced his candidacy. Bernie Sanders was seen as nothing more than a very fringe candidate making a statement by running for the nomination. Nobody saw this coming. Perhaps you did. I don't know of anybody who saw this coming.
Well, I will put myself right square in the middle. I had not the foggiest idea. I assumed that Trump would be a third-party candidate. Mm-hmm. Am as surprised as anyone else that he prevailed in the primary process. And one of the interesting aspects about America today is that we have these disappointing aspects of establishmentarian decisions. But we also have areas of governance that are quite impressive. And I'd like to make Johnson County a model for a second.
Mm-hmm.
We have differences of judgment on all sorts of issues in every community in America, every county in America. But basically, it's pragmatic governance. In Johnson County, it's a democratic liberal county, and so it's a little bit liberal. But if you replaced every elected official in Johnson County with somewhat more conservative people, they'd be making about the same decisions. I mean, this is you have pragmatic judgments to make at the local level. And you have personality differences on every city council, every board of supervisors. But they work in Iowa.
And this is perhaps the explanation that allowed you as a Republican. We had redistricting going on during your 30 years
sure.
of Congress. But you, Johnson County, was in your district. And you were reelected again and again as a Republican in a very liberal part of Iowa. So this is what allowed that?
Well, partly. I mean, and part of it, we've seen some changes in American political life, and we all have witnessed it. And there are precedents for partisanship at all times in American history. On the other hand, what's a little bit new is the almost incomprehensible lack of ability to reach any sort of compromise or any sort of respect between the parties that now exist at the highest levels of American politics. The lowest levels, it's a community attitude and that really holds people accountable. At the national level, it's become a kind of a fistfight. And I call it now caucus politics in Congress, where it used to be the two parties would have a caucus. That means where you'd get together all the members of one side in a big room and maybe three or four times a year to talk about how the process is coming up and the big issues, et cetera. And now they happen a couple times a week and they're more attuned to a football team at halftime. I mean, it's really how you organize to defeat the other side and strategies to defeat and strategies not to respect particularly. Sports has a higher ethic than politics today.
And the caucuses that you were involved in the 70s and 80s did not have that character so much?
Well, the early ones didn't. But then they – things don't happen overnight. I mean, there's a gradualism and there's a philosophical term that sometimes a matter of degree becomes a matter of kind. That is, you can have a 2 or 3% change for a few years and all of a sudden you, after a given amount of time, it's a 60% change and then an 80%. I mean, it becomes quite radically different, and it's different today.
Mm.
And in Congress today, oddly, some types of asking questions and come up with different results than another way of asking it. But historically, the biggest block of Americans have been center right and center left together. And that group of Americans is now virtually unrepresented in the United States Congress.
Mm.
And both parties, particularly the Republicans, have moved in a very distinctive way and in a very uncompromising way. The Democratic Party is more liberal than the center by a clear margin, but it's been a more stable, more liberal.
Mm-hmm. Is that when you recall, for instance, the election of 1856, the twilight of the Whig Party, is what we're experiencing now unprecedented, what you're just describing about no representation for the center right and center left?
Well, in that regard, it's very unusual in the American political scene, where we are today, always there in most of American history, you've had a vibrancy of differences between the parties, but also differences within the parties. Today, the differences within are not so great at the national level, the differences are between. It reminds me a little bit what I consider to be the most relevant speech in American history is the first inaugural of George Washington. And Washington argued that on how representatives should vote. And he said the national interest should come before the local. And he said there should be a national unity over disunity. And then he said there should be individual judgment rather than partisan allegiance. Very interesting that he laid this out, because it was discussed at the Constitutional Convention. It was discussed during the Articles of Confederation. How should people respond? And I think this is a very profound way. And then he said people should be guided by an immutable moral conscience. And that sounds very esoteric, but what he really was saying is that individual judgment comes before party. And it's a very profound observation. He also began a speech, which is the most odd beginning of any speech of any president or any governor ever, because he's talking to the Congress assembled in New York, and he begins by saying, and he's seeking their help, and he says, "You must understand, I have no civil administrative experience, and I wasn't born by nature with many abilities." In other words, the father of our country, the victorious general, was saying to the country that he wasn't real smart and he didn't have much experience. Well, no governor's ever said that. No president has ever said that. But in a way, it strikes me, all American presidents are in that position today, in the sense that we have so many issues, so complicated. No president can be an expert in all these things. And that's why it's important to have good people around him. Why, of all the bizarre statements of one of the presidential candidates said recently, he didn't need to listen to the military or admirals and generals or and to professors or to people that claim knowledge in specific areas, because he was pretty smart. Well, he may or may not be pretty smart, but the fact of the matter is everybody needs help. And everybody needs to balance ideas against other people's, and they need to respect other people's ideas. And if they don't, you're likely to have problems.
If you've just joined us, my guest this hour is former Congressman Jim Leach. He served Iowans for over 30 years in the U.S., for 30 years in the U.S. Congress, ending in 2007, giving us his thoughts on our current political system, set in historical context, what is precedented, what is unprecedented. If you'd like to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk. Our email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. I'd like to play a little bit of audio for you, Congressman. It represents the spectrum of political leaders reacting to the candidacy of Donald Trump and how he has run his campaign. And if I may play these three in fairly rapid succession, we'll start with Chris Christie in what is the closest embrace we have here of Donald Trump, endorsing Donald Trump back in February.
I've been on that stage. I've gotten to know all the people on that stage. And there is no one who is better prepared to provide America with the strong leadership that it needs, both at home and around the world, than Donald Trump.
Chris Christie back in February. Now moving on to Paul Ryan, our current House Speaker. In the middle, disavowing remarks made by Donald Trump, but still endorsing Donald Trump. Here he is making these remarks on Face the Nation last week when asked how he felt 1 week after endorsing Trump.
It could be better. I just obviously you've heard me disavow the comments regarding this judge. I don't think that those are appropriate comments by any stretch of the mind. Hopefully this is an inflection point. Hopefully a lesson will be learned here and we can move forward with a better campaign. That's my hope going forward.
Okay, Paul Ryan, Face the Nation last week. Here's Mitt Romney in total opposition to Donald Trump in the GOP, making this remark as part of a speech urging the GOP to stop Trump from being their presidential nominee back in March.
Think of Donald Trump's personal qualities, the bullying, the greed, the showing off, the misogyny, the absurd third grade theatrics. You know, we've long referred to him as the Donald. He's the only person in the entire country to whom we have added an article before his name. And it wasn't because he had attributes we admired.
Okay. There we have a pretty good representation of the spectrum. How unprecedented is this, is that members of the nominees or the presumed nominees' party have this wide a display of favor or opposition to their leader?
Well, it's not radically unusual for having a spectrum of views about candidates, especially those that have been in the mix. What is unusual is the campaign that has been run by the presumptive nominee. And that is basically he's run a nomination like the American Party known as the Know-Nothings in 1856.
In what ways?
Well, the heart of his – I mean, if you say where does Donald Trump stand on any issue, there are only two that come to people's mind. He's anti-Islamic and wants to put a fence at Mexican border. And so this is a anti-immigrant theme.
Mm-hmm. He can change his positions week by week, and that doesn't seem to affect his base support.
Well, that is true. And part of what's happening this year is an exaggeration of what is always somewhat in American politics. That is, there's more and more obviousness in that there are group identifications going on. And the groups themselves are less inclined to be divided. And so you have African Americans very heavily identified with one party. You have Hispanics that have become identified with the same party in greater numbers than before. And you have some aspects of cohesion around religious groupings in America in ways that are stronger than the norm. I mean, it used to be, for example, Catholics were 75% Democratic, and now quite possibly the reverse. Fundamentalists are overwhelmingly Republican. That could reverse. One never knows. But this is a circumstance where some people are less looking at the issues and they're looking at their people more like themselves as a reason for voting for someone. Mm-hmm. Now, historically, people looked at issues. People looked at the character of the nominee. And sometimes a Republican will vote for a Democrat because they find them of that person to be of ability that they like or character that they like, and vice versa. Today, it looks like character is less important than group identity.
Mm. Okay.
Or issue identity.
I'm going to come back in just a few moments to continue this conversation with former Congressman Jim Leach, served Iowa in the U.S. Congress for 30 years, ending in 2007. His thoughts on this current political season in the context of American historical politics. We'd like you to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. When we come back, we'll talk more about this campaign, some attributes of this campaign, to have the congressman comment on it, the rejection of political correctness in the context of civility in politics, which Congressman Leach has always stood for, the charges that the system is rigged, another hallmark of this political system. Back in just a moment with more of my conversation with former Congressman Jim Leach. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer. And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Former Congressman Jim Leach with us for the entire hours. Congressman Leach served for 30 years in the U.S. House of Representatives, ending in 2007. Following that time, he taught at Princeton, also at Harvard, now on the faculty at the University of Iowa College of Law, talking today about what is precedented and unprecedented in American politics, sort of taking a look at this current political season, making sense of it to the degree that we can, by looking at how the past may or may not be relevant and helpful. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Congressman Leach, new to many people this election is the degree of name-calling, specifically by Donald Trump. which has apparently been very effective for him in branding his primary opponents with names that stuck: Low Energy Jeb, Little Marco, Lying Ted, and now he's carrying that on into the general election campaign with names like Crooked Hillary, Crazy Bernie, and Goofy Elizabeth, referring to Elizabeth Warren. Is this something new that you know of?
Well, it's not new, whether it's uplifting is a matter of judgment for the people. And frankly, some of the positions are more troubling than the name calling. One aspect of civility is that a respectful dialogue is often more uplifting than otherwise. On the other hand, we have to recognize that vigorous debate is something to be respected. In fact, if you don't have vigorous debate, you have a tendency to dogmatism and possibly even tyranny. Now, having said that, I am just astonished at this campaign. It is
what astonishes you most?
Well, what is astonishes me the greatest is the on the one hand, some of the usage of manipulative words with implications that are devastating. I mean, a candidate who nonchalantly says we will not allow anyone of a particular religion to enter our country runs into constitutional problems. But not only that, true pragmatic problems, because if one declares war and implicitly on another religion, that enhances the radicals of that religion to feel vindicated and to counter-react with the war. The last thing the United States of America should want is another crusade. And the last thing we should want is to inspire another crusade. And one of the strengths of America often is that immigrants to our country become not only productive citizens but reflect to people where they are from good words about this country. It's no accident, for example, in Latin America, the government that was the most anti-America for years and still to some degree is was Cuban. But the people of Cuba like America better than any Latin American group of people. And one of the reasons is the Cubans that came here sent back word what a great country this is. And so if you take an Islamic citizen who comes to this country, who finds opportunity and freedom in ways that never existed in the country from which they came, they let their people back home know. Now, if that Islamic citizen finds exclusively anger and repression and prejudice, you get another reaction. And so our foreign policy in many ways begins right in our own neighborhoods, how we treat people, how we look at people, how we welcome or not welcome them. And I hate to see a government that looks askance. Now, there are precedents for this. And some under great American presidents. Franklin Delano Roosevelt will go down as one of the great presidents of the 20th century, if not in American history. And yet it's his administration that in 1939 blocked a ship called the MS St. Louis with 908 Jewish refugees from Germany and sent them back to Europe. Over half ended up being lost in the Holocaust. That is an extraordinary circumstance that we all should be appalled by. In World War II, it wasn't an act of Congress. It was a presidential decree that put Japanese Americans in not concentration camps, but camps that were basically mini prisons. This is bizarre. Whole families were brought up in prisons in World War II with not a hint of lack of patriotism. In fact, I visited one of these camps in Wyoming a few years ago and learned that there were two Medal of Honor winners from that camp. They didn't allow them to serve in the Far East. They served in Europe. I mean, that's extraordinary. And we take this for granted that this all occurred. And I just think we have to think about this. And that doesn't mean that if you're thinking of an Islamic citizen from Syria or Iran or Iraq that might want to come to this country, you need a background check. You've got to be very pragmatic about that. But it could be far more dangerous not to allow than to allow. And you might assume that one or two of these people might be imperfect. But are you going to create far more imperfect people by being prejudiced or by being open? And the more prejudiced we are, the more we are saying we welcome negative responses to our prejudice.
If you've just joined us, Congressman Jim Leach with us, ending in 2007. He served Iowa for 30 years in the U.S. House of Representatives. Let's go quickly to a call or two, if we could. Congressman Tom is listening in Beaverdale and has a question pertaining to our Supreme Court. Tom, what is your question?
Well, I was wondering what the senator or what the Professor Leach thinks about the Merrick Garland nomination in. I guess I think he's being sort of obstructed. I wonder if the congressman would agree.
Mm-hmm. And of course, our Senator Grassley at the center of it as the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, Tom. Right. So let's get Congressman Leach's view on this.
Well, first let me premise any comments I have with an expression of great respect for Chuck Grassley, who I think has been the greatest Republican senator in history, just like Tom Harkin was the greatest Democratic senator in our history. On this, I probably take a little different tack than Chuck, but he is constrained more than slightly by his caucus, and that's an awkward circumstance for him. I personally think that there is a chance after the election that this nominee will be considered by the Senate in the post-election session. I might have preferred a earlier time frame, but that could well happen, and I would hope so.
What do you mean by constrained by his caucus when you're talking about Chuck Grassley? What is preventing him, a very senior, from voting or doing as he pleases?
Well, the constraints are that his committee only brings people out to the floor. But if the leadership of the Republican Party will not allow a vote on the floor, it's a hapless act. And so he understands that, and he understands that he has some constraints in that regard. Now, there have been some precedents on his side in this, and there are a whole lot of precedents on the other side. My own view is that it would be better to proceed forthrightly, but that's a circumstance that I don't think is going to happen. I do think the nominee, from everything I know, without a hearing taking place, looks to be a man of enormous ability and fine principle, and it looks like he would be a relatively centrist judge. But this is a huge issue in American politics, and one of the intriguing things is there's a normal kind of instinct of many Americans. They prefer a little bit more conservative judge than a liberal judge. On the other hand, if you look at the issues, what is conservative and what is liberal? I think there could be nothing more conservative than to overturn Citizens United. And yet
that provided for unlimited spending by corporations.
That's
on,
right.
And instead, basically, money is free speech.
That's right. And it basically defines corporations as having First Amendment rights, and to have First Amendment is a the whole Bill of Rights is an individual rights manifesto. And so it implies that a corporation is an individual and that money is speech, which I consider to be a nonsensical ruling, something our founders would have laughed at. And I would say overturning it is conservative. A liberal would say it's liberal. But for the life of me, I think it is doing enormous damage to the American political process, and it's moving us in an oligarchic corporatist direction when we should be moving in a more democratic direction. By more democratic, I don't mean anything related to a party. I mean we need to have a system in which the average American knows that they play a part. And today we have a system in which many Americans feel they're being manipulated.
Mm-hmm. And the word rigged comes out from the mouth of Bernie Sanders, also from Donald Trump, and they gain their support from the feeling you just described.
And rigged is an over-exaggerated term, but there are elements that are valid. And unfortunately, Iowa's a problem in this.
How so?
Well, if you take the Democratic Party, which runs a caucus differently than the Republican Party, it has three elements that to me are deeply irrational. One is that they have superdelegates, and 15% nationwide as a rule are superdelegates. That's 30% of half. In other words, the superdelegates are really powerful governing forces in a convention. But on Iowa specific, why in heaven's name do you have a system in which if you, Ben, are a candidate in a caucus and you get 10% of the vote, you don't get counted because you need 15% to even be counted. Now, in Chicago, there's the old joke that if you want to get a big vote out, you go to the cemetery to get some support and the dead vote. In Iowa, we have a circumstance. If I would have gone to this Democratic caucus and voted for you and you only got 10%, I would be a living soul who wouldn't be counted. How outrageous is that? I mean, my vote would not have counted. I think that is a travesty. Now, beyond that, in the Democratic caucus, then it adds a, quote, fun element, but it is truly undemocratic. To get to the second vote, you have to line up in one part of a room or another in the Democratic caucus. And so someone in one corner is for Hillary and another corner for Bernie in last year and another court for Governor O'Malley. Governor O'Malley didn't get many 15%, so he didn't get counted. But he was a very decent man, very decent candidate. But you had to show who you were voting for. The heart of democracy is privacy. It's a secret ballot. That's the way you vote, is through a secret ballot. In the Democratic caucuses of Iowa, there is no privacy, and that is a Democratic umbrage of a dimension. I cannot tell you how large it is. And it stops some people from going to caucuses. It causes other people to vote not the way they want to vote. And I will give an example, and I want to make this very, very clear. In the year 2000, the Democratic Party had two prominent candidates, Al Gore, who was a very estimable man, and Bill Bradley, who was a very extraordinary individual, happens to be one of my closest friends. The unions of Iowa decided to endorse Al Gore, and they had everyone line up in advance of their caucuses and gather together, and they all voted as a block. Well, many union members preferred Bill Bradley. But because of the public nature of it, if they'd had a secret ballot, Bill Bradley might have won the Iowa caucuses. If he'd have won the Iowa caucuses, he definitely would have won the New Hampshire caucuses. He would have been the Democratic – or New Hampshire primary. He'd have been the Democratic nominee. The Democratic Party may have elected George W. Bush in the Iowa Democratic caucuses. That's an extraordinary thought that I would ask the Democratic Party to think seriously about.
Former Congressman Jim Leach. Right,
but I want to go further.
Okay,
if I can. Nationwide, there's a difference between caucuses and primaries. Caucuses are designed for insiders much more than primaries are. Iowa is kind of an in-between because we have the world's largest caucuses, but they're still smaller than primaries. I think the country ought to go to primaries and that these other states that have caucuses are de minimis. The only case for a caucus in Iowa is to try to assure us to being first, something we may never be again, or at least never be again alone. But I think the case for caucuses is very slight and that we ought as a society try to be going to get more participation. The primary process is the weakest part of American democracy. It should be strengthened through far greater participation and through, state government-controlled elections.
Former Congressman Jim Leach with us. unfortunately, just a few minutes left with the congressman this hour to talk about what is precedented and unprecedented in American politics. Before we do leave this hour, Congressman Leach, I'd like to share this comment and have you react to it. A comment by conservative columnist David Brooks of the New York Times. It's from a column in late April that he wrote. If I could quote him, he says, they seem blithely unaware that this is a Joe McCarthy moment. People will be judged by where they stood at this time. Those who walked with Trump will be tainted forever after for the degradation of standards and the general election slaughter. Now, a Joe McCarthy moment, we have to be of some age to remember this firsthand, but this is the late 40s, early 50s, Senator McCarthy, a senator from Wisconsin, spending years trying to expose communists, other left-wing loyalists in the U.S. government during the hyper-suspicious period of the Cold War. Any notion of disloyalty was enough to convince many Americans that their government was packed with traitors and spies. It was a time of intimidation, and it was not until he attacked the army in 1954 that his actions earned him the censure of the U.S. Senate. This is an exchange between Joseph Welch, chief counsel for the United States Army, and Senator Joseph McCarthy during the Army-McCarthy hearings from June of 1954.
Let us not assassinate this lad further, Senator.
Let's
You've done enough. Have you no sense of decency, sir? At long last, have you left no sense of decency?
Okay, so the question, David Brooks, conservative columnist, saying this is a Joe McCarthy moment. How do you feel about that? Do you agree with David Brooks?
Well, first, let me say America has a lot to learn from the Joe McCarthy moment, and it was a anti-communist moment in which we had a reason to be concerned for communism but no reason to be concerned for the types of disparaging of Americans that McCarthy set forth, and it was a disgrace for the country. Now, having said that, and I have an enormous respect for David Brooks, who I think is one of the finest columnists of an era. But having said that, the analogies break down a little bit. I think what he's really saying is judgmentally, there's no tie to anti-communism here. But there is a tie that David is making that is not one-to-one, and it's a little frail, between a judgment call and whether or not you support Mr. Trump and the style of negative suggestions he's making about opponents and the way he's making them. But it would be – I mean – what Trump is doing is making personal assaults, not patriotic assaults, and that's a big difference. I don't agree with his style. I don't agree with his judgment. I think he's an extremely flawed candidate, but he's not using the exact same tactics as Joe McCarthy, and so I would be really I'd be really cautious about that.
Mm-hmm. We have just a couple minutes left. I'd like to ask you, when you look forward to the many several months of the campaign left until the November election, what do you see ahead? And what are the questions in your mind that will only be found out as we proceed through these months?
Well, the only prediction I make is we've got some surprises to come, and who knows what they're going to be. This has been a year of surprises, and they may not be over. One of the possible implications is that acts of others will affect how Americans will line up at the end. And for example, does this attack in Orlando, does that make Americans more inclined to move towards an anti-Islamic candidate such as Trump? That's conceivable. It's also quite conceivable that Americans will look at all aspects of Trump's background and find him one of the few candidates that a Democrat could defeat this year. And then you have issues of Mrs. Clinton, who's running basically as a mainstream Democratic candidate that's been pushed a bit to the left by Bernie, but has other kinds of liabilities that not everyone is identifying with. And I think to predict now who's going to win or lose would be a mistake. This could be a surprisingly close race.
Mm-hmm. Very quickly before we go in just a few seconds, if you could wave a wand and change one thing about our politics, what would it be? The money you mentioned?
Well, I think the easiest precise thing that could be done is changing Citizens United. But the bigger, deeper thing is to renew a greater respect between the parties.
Thank you very much. Former U.S. Congressman Jim Leach. Tomorrow in Iowa City, he'll be giving a public talk at 7 p.m. at the Englert Theater, What is Precedented and Unprecedented in American Politics. Congressman Leach, we really appreciate you coming in. Thank you so much.
Well, honored to be with you, Ben.
River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon with help from Lauren Knutson. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tweet me if you'd like to suggest a discussion for a future show. Tweet me at IPRBen. Thanks for joining us.